The Center Steer Podcast, a Land Rover podcast by Land Rover owners. Welcome to the 23rd edition of the Center Steer Podcast. It is the 22nd of February, 2015. I am your host, John, from southwestern Pennsylvania, and it was barely cold. Thankfully, it's warmed up a little bit to 32 degrees. Who imagined that 32 degrees Fahrenheit would be warm, but it feels warm here. We have a cavalcade of stars today joining us from two continents and one island. So I will just tell you who's on. Sitting across from me is Harold, and on Skype we have Mark Garcia, and we have Morgan from Vermont. We have from the island of Vilhaven.
Vinyl Haven.
We have Jeff Aronson with the Rovers North magazine, Rovers magazine. He's the editor. From Birmingham, Matt Cooper of Land Rovers Live, and our special guest that we had a problem with last month, Matt Dan. I get all the names right. Dan with the 4x4 podcast. Say hi, Dan.
Howdy. Thanks for having me back. Hopefully this time everything will go smoothly.
I can only hope. You don't have a hard cutoff, do you?
Nah, not this time.
Next week sometime.
So we will start off. We have a bunch of things to talk about. I will give it a little preview is that Jeff was in Iceland, and he's going to tell us about that. We have Matt is going to tell us some changes coming up to Land Rovers Live, and we have some news to discuss. But we want to begin by talking to Dan, as he's one of the inspirations for me having a podcast and starting everything, because when I started looking at starting the podcast nearly 2 years ago, actually it was 2 years ago I started thinking about it, Dan was the only podcast that I recall seeing that was even remotely close to 4x4 podcast. So Dan, I want to thank you and ask you, how did the 4x4 podcast begin?
Well, the podcast started back in 2011, and I was actually stationed in South Korea. So I'm in the military, and so I am frequently separated from all the joys of off-roading for pleasure. And so at that time, 3 years overseas without my Jeep, and I needed to do something to stay connected to the off-roading community. And so I had a friend who hosted the geocaching podcast, and he convinced me to go ahead and start one. And he gave me the help kind of get things going, because I had no idea how to do that. I just knew that I liked talking about off-roading, and that's kind of how it launched. Initially, my brother at the time, and even to today, he is more into rallycross with a Nissan 350Z, which is like off-roading once. But then I had one of the listeners step up, Craig. He's now my co-host. And so we talk everything, whether it be desert racing, overlanding, just cruising through the terrain parks in the various areas, and everything in between. So pretty wild topics.
You guys recently went to the King of Hammers. Is that correct?
Yeah. Craig, my co-host, he lives in California. And so he's, you know, off-roading is very popular in California, and so he's been able to go to the Off-Road Expo and the SandSport Super Show a couple times, and this year was the first time he went down to King of the Hammers. And so he rented an RV and spent, I think, exactly a week out there in Johnson Valley. So he got to see King of the Motos, the Everyman Challenge, and all the Ultra 4, the big boy million-dollar race cars. So he had a great time.
And what was your first vehicle? I know it wasn't a Land Rover, but we
have no. I've only driven a Land Rover a couple times actually, but it was a Defender 110 actually in Afghanistan.
All right, good choice.
Oh, American military or British military?
It was American military. It was North American spec, I guess. I mean, it was left-hand drive.
That doesn't mean much. It wasn't North American spec. They still exported left-hand drives.
I think there was some I have a friend who was in the military. I think he was in the Rangers or going to be in the Rangers, and he said they had bought a bunch of military spec Defenders. So I wonder if that's part of that.
It very well could be. I mean, it sounded like it had the top down, even though it was a hard top every time we'd go driving around. I could look back in the rearview mirror and see daylight through the gaps in the doors.
Yeah.
Was fine, except for when we're driving through dusty or rainy conditions and the exterior stuff wanted to come inside.
I'll let you in a little secret, Dan. They're quieter with the top down.
I believe it. I believe it. But my first vehicle, let's see, I started learning to drive on an 83 Ford Ranger with a four-cylinder diesel and a manual transmission. My grandpa we were out working on the farm, and he stopped in the middle of a hay field and got out, walked around, and pushed me over from the passenger seat when I was 9 years old and said, "All right, you're going to learn to drive this thing. Just don't crash it into the pond." And that's kind of how it all started. So somebody asked, like, how did you get into off-roading? I said, well, I got into driving, and since everything within 20 miles was dirt, everything was off-road. I just didn't realize it. So that's kind of how my passion for off-roading grew. But since then, you know, I drove to high school in a Dodge D100, which was not a four-wheel drive, but it was a big, heavy steel pickup truck. I've had a Yukon, I've had a Suburban, I've had a Yukon XL now. I'm on my second Jeep Cherokee. And, you know, one of the more interesting ones is while I was in Korea, I had a 94, I think it was, Hyundai Galloper, which is, it shares a platform, is very similar to the Mitsubishi something, I can't remember.
At the Montero?
Outlander?
Yeah, it's very similar to Montero, but it's old generation. But it had a four-cylinder diesel with a five-speed transmission, seated 9 passengers, and would still get 26 miles a gallon combined between highway and around town.
Yep.
So your podcast covers not just some of the shows, but you've also done some overlanding activities. I guess you post things like a blog. What things do you have planned that maybe you haven't done yet, or what's been your favorite things to do as part of your podcast?
You know, my favorite things to do, I got to be a co-driver in the Baja 1000 back in 2012. And so that was a phenomenal experience. That's always been a lifelong dream. And the podcast kind of opened the door, I think, to make that happen. I've got press credentials. I went down to the New York International Auto Show and got to see the official launch of the 2014 Jeep Cherokee, which I'm not a real fan of, but, you know, it's good to see a new development in the segment. I got to go partake or help cover the inaugural Vermont Overland Trophy, and that was a really fun experience. I was only there for 2 of the 4 competition days. And I use competition in quotation marks because back then it was still kind of working out the kinks. I think it's developed into a lot more now going forward. But here going in the future, just this week I found out that I'm going to be moving to Alaska this summer. So
it's confirmed?
It is confirmed. It is a real thing. So I've got a lot of work to do. I've got to help. And I've got to sell my flatbed trailer that the Jeep usually rides across the country on, because I think this time we are going to drive the whole thing. So that's pretty exciting.
Not mistaken, I think the latest edition of Rover's Magazine had an article about someone coming driving back from Alaska.
I read that, actually.
It was the holiday 2014 issue, and that very correspondent, Sarah Hamilton, let me know just recently that she and her family are considering moving back to Alaska to, I believe it's pronounced Kenai, Alaska. Does that sound right, Dan?
I wouldn't know. I've only looked at it as a dream, and now it's a reality. And I'm going to be moving to the interior part of Alaska, up to Fairbanks. So okay. It's exciting.
Jeff, why don't you give the contact info to Dan? They can put together a convoy.
Sure. I'd be happy to do that, Dan.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. I've got a couple people who have said that they've always wanted to do it, and so, hey, the more the merrier as far as I'm concerned.
There's a fellow here in Maine that I met at the Maine Winter Romp who's talking about going back to work on fishing boats there this coming season.
Excellent.
So when do you move to Alaska then?
It'll be sometime between June and July. I think there, if you drive nonstop, it is 3 days drive from where I'm at here outside Kansas City. So once you break that up for sleeping time and then visiting family and friends, I imagine it'll take probably 2 weeks to get there. Yeah. So, and that's kind of the leisurely plan that I have right now, because we do have a lot of family and friends going from here in the middle of the United States all the way up through the Pacific Northwest. And then I'm sure we'll make some friends crossing through the Yukon territory.
Will Uncle exciting. Sam be flexible on your timing?
Yes, maybe.
Okay.
As usual.
Can I help you with that?
Yes. That is one of the good things. You know, I've got to see the world by living in various places a couple months at a time. Rather than trying to vacation, I get paid to go do these things. So that is one of the benefits.
How long might you spend in Alaska? Is that a 2-year stint?
I think it's 3 years. However, that could change. That's kind of one of the political things is, as we do base closures and trying to squeeze all the money out of the budget, they could be closing and shutting down the units up there or closing bases. I don't know. That's not my decision to make. So I just go to,
just go where you're told.
Exactly.
So what else is planned for the 4x4 podcast? And I know since we've kind of connected, you've tried to include a little more Land Rover content. We appreciate that.
Well, yeah, it's good now that I have somebody who knows more about Land Rovers. My experience prior to a couple months ago was just looking at them and sitting in them, but I haven't really had a whole lot of experience operating them. But, you know, it's there is a long
that.
You know, if somebody could put me in a Land Rover more often, I would love that.
Yes, you would. We do.
Somebody can hand me the keys to anything.
We do have a couple things we need to correct. And listening to one of your recent podcasts or two, there are three things I'd like to correct with you, if I may.
Now, the caveat is, if it was Craig, he's off the rails every now and then. If it's me, I think that's one thing.
The first one is the Honda ownership. There was a mention, I think that was Craig. There was never Honda ownership. Honda never owned Land Rover. There was a partnership, I guess, and they rebadged the Discovery One as a, what was it called? I forget.
Crossroad, I think.
Crossroad. So there was a couple years they did rebadge the Discovery One, but I don't think it was ever available in the United States.
No.
So that's the
That sounds
the connection.
That sounds like the relationship that the Hyundai had with the Mitsubishi platform that I had. It was the same thing, just had a different grill or different badge on the front end.
The difference being that I think there was an equity share between Mitsubishi and Hyundai for a number of years, and they had actually a number of shared platforms.
So interesting. Next up is there was, I think, and again, I think this was Craig.
It was Craig. Trust me.
Mentioned about the engine being a Jaguar engine in the Land Rover, and that was actually not the case. The original one, anyways, is a Buick bought engine, and I think Harold certainly knows more about that than I. They're moving to their own built engines now.
Well, the Rover V8's discontinued, but
that was the Buick engine.
As of 1970, it became the Rover V8, and it went into just about everything British, except Jaguar, who was vehemently opposed.
But now they're building.
That's smart. That's smart of Jaguar.
That's maybe the only smart thing Jaguar did. Sorry. Harold's a big Jag fan. Sorry.
Well, Jag really wanted to get their own V8 program going, and it was a political thing with corporate. But Jag did eventually produce a good V8, and that is now what is powering the Land Rovers as of 2005.
Harold, if we can reminisce to the time that Jaguar bought Daimler in the UK, they had a fabulous opportunity with that lovely little 2.5 V8 that was in the SP250.
Right, the little Hemihead engine.
That was a sweet engine.
Those things are still popular in racing, Jeff.
I believe it. It was a great engine. You still see them here at in Daimler's at British Auto Shows. It sounds lovely.
Collaboration. Was that part of British Leyland?
No, it was prior to that. I think it was in the 40s when they bought Daimler.
Oh. No, it was later than that, but because Daimler was still producing under its own ownership. But it had nothing to do with Leyland. It was kind of a preemptive step by Jaguar, which was looking at the fact that it was going to be pushed into the British Leyland fold. And it was really to grab a handle on that embassy slash consulate slash government ministry fleet purchase of vehicles. Daimler really had a lock on those.
Right.
And for a while, Harold, help me here, but for a while, essentially, Daimler was kind of badge engineering Jaguars, just the same product
under a different name.
The Sovereign and models like that to keep the Daimler name alive, but it was really a Jaguar product.
That is correct.
Things I didn't know. That's interesting. Good stuff. So we have one last item that we need to clarify with Dan, and that is reliability. So I know it's an issue, but Land Rovers are yes, they can be unreliable, but you know, as with anything, it needs care and attention. And that's the love that you bring to the Land Rover brand, is you need to love it in order to keep it reliable.
Yeah, I think I referred to that as like the battered wife syndrome, where it's a loving relationship, but you just keep going back to it for some reason.
Pretty much.
So this is not a time for me to talk about my Jeep experiences, Dan, with reliability.
That's true. That's true. There are some Jeeps that have been known to do that. However, I will say that is why I am such a fan of the Cherokee, because it's a simple vehicle to work on. It's extremely reliable. Mine has been left in the pasture of, you know, a friend's house while I was in Iraq for 15 months, and I came back, fired it right up, and no issues except for when I got up to highway speed, my tires that had been extremely old kind of all blew out at the same time from dry rot. But mechanically, it was sound. Same thing. I went to Afghanistan, came back, no issues. So I'm glad that my XJ is extremely reliable and doesn't need a lot of attention. So, but that can't be said for all Jeeps. I know that's true.
It can't be said for all cars. I mean, really, every car will fail, have a problem. They're mechanical. You need to do care and maintenance. And
especially if they're neglected, they won't do well.
Yeah, exactly.
That is true. Yeah. And that's one of the things I do mention on the podcast a lot is that, you know, I do all of my preventive maintenance at home while I'm in the driveway and making sure everything is mechanically sound. So that way, when I do go out on these trips, go off-roading, I can actually enjoy that experience. You know, I know lots of great stories come from the trials and tribulations of dealing with headaches out in the adventure. However, I'd much rather, you know, enjoy the adventure and let that present its own challenges rather than my vehicle.
I agree. I deal with those problems for my job. So if I'm going out in the woods, I want to not take my job with me if I can.
Exactly.
Somebody had to change their starter in the bitter cold this week.
Yeah.
D2. Yeah.
Wow.
Well, at least the 109 wouldn't start in this nasty, nasty cold. It got down to, what, negative 10 or something Fahrenheit. And it just sapped I cranked it too much and sapped the battery juice, but it just wouldn't start. It was too cold.
And we're going to fix that this afternoon.
John, do you hold the clutch in when you do that?
I do not.
You should, because you need to relieve as much drivetrain pressure as possible. You've got 7.5 quarts of oil trying to circulate, and if you have the original style 109, even the Series 3 109 starter, you really have a fairly low cranking speed. So you need to ease as much burden as possible on the whole system. So hold the clutch in while you try and crank. You'll get faster cranking speed.
And part of the issue there, too, is you have a gearbox full of 90 weight, which is quite
excellent
when it's cold.
Very true. Nicely put.
Cold. When, you know, my truck is a 24-volt system, and it doesn't have any glow plugs. And Harold told me when we when we were getting it up and running, he said, we're not going to put any glow plugs in. It doesn't on those extreme situations when it gets too cold, just don't drive it. And guess what? We were this week, it was that time when it was too cold, so I didn't drive it. We were supposed to go off. The club went off-roading yesterday for its for we called the Winter Classic, and they went up into the mountains above Ligonier, Pennsylvania. And nope, wouldn't start. Tried Thursday, tried Friday, and even tried Saturday morning. But there you go.
Well, the overwhelming majority of days we have, it's above 30, and at that temperature, it starts fine without glow plugs.
Yeah, I started it last weekend. Not a problem. So, Dan, that's the 4x4 podcast. I want to thank you for what you did to inspire me to go out and do one for this, and thank you for doing what you do. I, as a fellow podcaster, I know it's tough, and you do a nice job and do a great job of getting content out there. And you got extra challenges with with being in the military and having to move around and not sure what's going on day to day. So kudos to you.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we're getting close to episode 100, which I think for any podcast is usually they fade by between 7 and 10. So for this to continue on is really great. But you know, it's great to have such a wonderful community to be a part of. The list of interviewees has me stretched out far longer than I can. You know, I have to apologize to people because there's so many people doing cool stuff in the off-roading community, and I can't get to everybody in the time that I have. So that's why, you know, I'd like seeing your podcast out there. I want to see more, you know, more off-roading podcasts niche down to specific brands because it gives me something to learn about. Like I said, I've learned a lot listening to your guys' podcast here. I subscribe to the Rovers North magazine. I've got that sitting right there next to the commode.
Most do, by the way, most do.
Is that for compiling your wish list?
I do like getting through there and seeing that you could actually buy all the components and build your own Land Rover from scratch. That is pretty exciting to see.
With nothing more than a bucket of bolts and 12 wrenches.
Exactly. But, you know, it's before it gets relegated to commode duty or duty.
I'm not cutting that out.
You know, I sat down the other night and I read the article about the first winter drive up to the top of Mount Washington with my 8-year-old daughter. And, you know, it's good experience for her. It inspires that adventure spirit within her. And, you know, it's just, I love reading about that stuff that is just a little bit foreign to what I'm used to. It's good to be well-rounded like that.
It was a good article. I did read that one. That's pretty interesting. But the only set of vehicles able to make it to the top without needing a snowcat.
Without a snowcat, yeah. Pretty exciting.
Did you notice the part where they said it took them 7 hours to get up, but only took them like 2 hours to get down?
It helps gravity, plus you've already crossed over some of the tracks and broken up the trail.
Right. And the one guy here down his 110 to like 8 PSI.
Sounds about right.
Well, thanks again, Dan, for joining us. I hope you stay for the rest of the show and chime in as you want. I know you're not a Rover guy necessarily, but we are trying to convert you.
You know, I could probably be easily swayed. If I had my choice, I would have a garage full of all kinds of off-roading vehicles. Trust me.
Would we not all? I absolutely. And that one, and I'm already envious because you've been in a military 110. So, boom, right there. That's big news right there.
Dan, I just wanted to say something real quick. One of the things I noticed that you're doing now is you're supplementing your podcasts with content on your website. Kind of like that as a good idea because it gets more stuff out there more regularly so people aren't waiting for the next episode and maybe forgetting about you.
Yeah, well, it's kind of an interesting way to stay connected to the audience because sitting down and recording the podcast itself and doing all the post-production stuff, that is time-consuming. But we also have a lot of companies that have been reaching out to us to review their products and get our opinion on them. And just do, you know, cover everything else in the industry. And then a lot of the times, if we have something on the website that really strikes a chord and generates a lot of comments, we'll make sure that's included in the podcast because we do like having it as a dialogue rather than just a one-way thing because that's really where we learn everything. And, you know, recently I've been talking about building a off-roading trailer as well. And so that's generating a lot of discussion. I think that's something that's everybody's lust-worthy off-roading toy. So,
and I imagine there's a lot of different opinions as to how to do that.
There are. And what I'm looking at doing is taking a different approach. Rather than having a fully fabricated trailer frame, I'm going to I'm looking at using one of the Harbor Freight trailers and just doing some reinforcement, building it's called an Explorer box, and basically it's just a wooden box that sits on top of the trailer that, you know, will hold all of the camping gear. But I'm also looking at getting a rooftop tent to either go on top of the box or on top of the probably my wife's Yukon for now as we convoy north, because we're looking at getting the Tipui Grand Sabana. Their biggest tent. Since it's my wife and me plus three kids and a dog, we'll need a tent that's got a lot of real estate.
One of the friends in the Land Rover community, Matt Smith, I guess. Is that? No.
Tim Smith.
Thank you. He has a Sankey trailer, which is a military Land Rover trailer, and he has a tent on top of that, and that's what he tows with him and to the trail site.
I'd like to do.
Yeah, there is no limit on the different variations of the camping trailers. I mean, while out there at Vermont Overland Trophy, you know, we saw everything from like a M101 trailer loaded with stuff to custom fabricated ones to something that you would see out in Australia that actually opens up like a clamshell and it's got a, you know, a regular queen size bed plus floor space and camp set up. And there's just such a wide range of things. So I'm going to try something that's different.
Have you seen the Dormobile, Land Rover Dormobile?
Yes. That one is fantastic. I don't know that my Cherokee could handle that, though.
Well, we can cut the top off. Not a problem.
And then it would crumble in the middle.
The ticket, though, is a Forward Control 101 that you convert into sleeping bays. That's a ticket. I know of two in Montreal that the guy apparently has enough that he has people drive them to the campsite, then he falls along.
Yeah, there's a company that's only 3 hours from here called Global Expedition Vehicles, and they'll take they've got a couple different platforms. They'll use like the Stewart & Stevenson, like the military LMTV uses that same platform. They've got Unimog platforms, and what they'll do is put the camping platform, the box, on the back. But I saw it's extremely, extremely popular brand. They do them all custom order, so they don't have like an inventory that they maintain. But I saw just this week Jesse James of the Monster Garage fame actually bought one for his trophy truck racing program to take down to Baja. So if Jesse James is going to these guys to get their custom trailer, they must be doing some great work. So I'm going to go pay them a visit and explore some of the Ozarks area while I'm down there.
That sounds like a good special episode of your podcast.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that one. I've already talked to their PR guy, and we're getting things lined up so I can go down there when it's nice, when they've got a cool vehicle in the late stages of the build, so we can check it out and maybe do some camping, overlanding, connect with some of the guys that are down there in the Ozarks doing some cool stuff in the overlanding segment.
You think they'll let you shoot some video?
Absolutely. Video certainly is not my expertise, but I know everybody wants to see what it looks like. So if nothing else, we'll get a lot of pictures.
So what is the website that people go to? Even though I will have I'll have it in the show notes, but let's be audio. Let's do it audio. What is this, where the people can keep track of you and your events and activities?
Yeah. So the website is the 4x4podcast.com, and that's 4x4 like you would see it on the side of any proper four-wheel drive vehicle.
You mean like the best 4x4 by far?
Exactly, except it's not spelled out. It's just the numbers, 4x4. But we'll have links there to our Facebook page and Twitter and Instagram and all those different places.
Absolutely. And I'm not mistaken, I think there's some M-word is now being popular on your side.
We're trying to get some cross-promotion and drive some people over here to the Center Steer podcast.
Yes, I have been asked to guest contribute to the website.
Yeah, that's great. No, I'd be happy to have more people listen and chime in. All right, Dan, thanks again very much for joining us. And again, I hope you stay and listen and chime in, please, for the rest of the podcast.
Yeah, I'm not going anywhere. I got my drink right here.
What are you drinking?
I think it's just a Diet Coke this time. I just grabbed whatever was the first thing I could reach before I ran downstairs.
I will now channel Clarkson. Time for the news. So last orders for the Land Rover Defender are, there's an article on Land Rover's Owner International. Apparently, if you want to order one, you got to get it in by June.
You think they'd let me order it now for delivery in 25 years?
I think Matt would help us out with that. Matt could order one for us, and he could hold it for 25 years. What do you say, Matt?
Yeah, well, I have to clear some space in the shed, but I'm sure I could figure that one out.
I'm not sure I'd want it after Matt had it for 25 years.
No, I think that'd be a wise move.
Apparently, there's also going to be, there may be a final edition. So, you know, there's the Adventure Edition, there's the Heritage Edition, there's the Autobiography Edition, and then there may be a final edition, which will have a 503 Breaking Horsepower 5.0 Supercharged V8 that comes from the Range Rover Sport slotted into the Defender.
AKA the XKR.
So if you are outside the United States, you're outside of North America, and you want your Defender, and you can import it, or you're in the UK, get your order in.
I think what's really interesting about that as well is all of the special edition Defenders have gone, that they went a couple of weeks ago. So if you're in the market for one of those, then sadly you've missed the boat there. But then at the same time, you've got other companies like Carn Design and Bespoke who are really trying to replicate some of the special editions. So you can get a 500 horsepower Defender today from companies like Carn Design and Bespoke and probably customize, you know, take a 25-year-old one and do the same thing to it so you guys could get a hold of one as well.
At least over here, Icon, which is our sort of our version of Con Design and Bespoke, they finally have done a couple of Defenders. I've been waiting a long time to see them do theirs.
Yeah, well, their Defenders are actually from Neen Overland in the UK. They've got a sort of some sort of switch up deal where Neen Overland takes the Mustangs from Icon, and in return they get sent Defenders from Neen. I had a meeting about that the other day. It was quite interesting because I didn't know.
Sounds like a nice trade.
Yeah. So
totally.
Because of course we can get Mustangs over here, but we can't get high powered ones. So Icon send those over so we can have spoofed up Mustangs, and you guys get Defenders.
So is that how you're getting the Mustangs? Then I saw that on Top Gear a couple weeks ago, right? They mentioned about Mustangs being able to be imported now.
Yes, so the Mustangs that Top Gear mentioned, those will be the steering wheel on the proper side of the vehicle. It's only a base model. Whereas via Icon, we can get full power Mustangs, which are non-Euro compliant, effectively.
Okay, that's what Clarkson was talking about. Then okay, that makes more sense because he was asking for the top of the line, V8.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. So get your orders in if you want your Defender before. Oh, that was the thing I remembered. There's also been a little chatter that the Defender may continue to be built, but outside of the UK, it may move to India, and they may build it there. So it may not, in fact, really be over. Yes, which brings us to a really nice article I saw on the BBC under their auto edition, which if you've actually not checked out the BBC auto page, I think it's really nice. They do a nice job, not just with Land Rover stuff, but they do a nice job in general with automobiles. They cover, I think, things pretty well. They had a really nice written article called Land Rover Defender's Last Stand. And it just if you like the model, if you are interested in it, like we all typically are, it was a nice read. It was just it made you feel good and warm inside and gave you that nice warm and fuzzy about why you like the brand, why you like that model. I think, Morgan, you read it and had the same feeling, if I'm not mistaken.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was a great one.
I thought it was very well done. In fact, they even talked to the Icon guy, which is that Los Angeles-based builder of 4x4s, and they had a comment or two in there. It's a very nice article. It was, gives you that warm and fuzzy. If you ever want to explain to your friends and family why you like this, I could see someone handling this article to them and say, yeah, this explains it right here.
Not as efficiently as taking them for a ride. But maybe. You do what you got to do sometimes.
What you got to do. That's right. Along those lines, there is an article from motoringresearch.com called Throwback Thursday, Visit to Land Rover. So if you want to know what the what this person's experience was in doing the Land Rover Experience and doing the off-roading course, it was a nice read. It was it resonated with me because it was similar to the experience I'd had going there and doing the off-roading portion. And there's some pictures and video of the building of the Defender and some discussion about how that takes place and what's going on with that. So if you may want to check that article out, again, we'll have a link in the show notes. That's Throwback Thursday was the name of that article.
John, if I may put a pitch in here, I've become interested in the Land Rover Experience over the years as a part of the brand's DNA, and took it upon myself to contact instructors from Land Rover Experience around the world. And a future article in Rover's magazine will have some of those interviews with instructors in the UK, in Estonia, and here in the US. I'm always interested in what the thrust of off-roading means. Matt, you may well be familiar with this if you've traveled outside the UK. But what off-roading means to us in the U.S. is often different than what it means to people in other landscapes in other countries. The thrill of adventure is central, and the sense of adventure being a part of your life is central. But what we actually mean by off-road can be very different. And I thought it would make an interesting article, and the more I've talked to folks, including most recently the head of the Land Rover Experience, David Sneath, in the UK, really opened my eyes as to how that's evolved over the years and how it has to evolve in order to meet the local needs, if you will, of each of the countries it operates in. So it's been an interesting entity. I'm glad you mentioned it, John.
You raise an interesting point, Jeff. You talk about off-roading being different from one country to the next. It's really quite different even within our own country.
Yes. Yep, very true, Dan. Yep. Well put.
Well, of course, the UK has green laning, which is not a typical thing we do here. Usually ours is gravel.
Well, there's often green laning in different parts of the country. I think up where Morgan is, they have some of that kind of thing, too. But, here in our part of the country, it's a lot about, going through the woods with narrow trails and lots of trees. And people who have been out west where it's wide open spaces come here and they suddenly think their truck is too wide to make it through the woods, for instance.
Yes, we've had an experience with a gentleman who had a Disco 3. Goes and says, "Oh yeah, I know how to off road. I know how to off road. Yeah, no problem. I've done out west all the time. We go out in the woods. We drive for hours." And he comes here and goes into the woods and goes 5 feet and gets stuck because he's all, my truck's too long. It's not right for this area.
And then down south, it's more about the mud. So it has to do with geology and geography.
Right, right. Next up, Land Rover Jaguar to recall 100,000 vehicles. Apparently, there's here in the United States, North America, there is a problem with brakes and lights. I mention it in case you have a newer Range Rover in particular. Now, you may want to make sure if you've not been contacted to, because brakes are important. You might want to stop.
Every now and then you might want them.
Yeah. If I could, this entire recall issue, which is bedeviling all the major manufacturers in numbers that kind of stagger you, because you never used to hear of recalls in that number unless it was somebody's tires, like the Firestone episode of a decade ago. This is all preemptive. There hasn't been a notice to NHTSA, our national agency, about this as a problem. It's a potential problem that was picked up potentially around brake line issue, and then similarly as to whether brake lights would work at a certain moment. So when you run your pre-tests, you come across this. Both federal government pressure here in the U.S. and consumer pressure is to catch these things well in advance, and it's actually easier to do this in these great numbers as they're doing, rather than face, say, the Takata airbag issue, which is multiple brand and across multiple platforms with a product that can't even be produced fast enough.
Yeah, and that still hasn't even been completely finished yet. I mean, there's still lots of conversations about the airbag issue, but points well taken, Jeff. I mean,
I see these numbers now, and God, every vehicle must be falling apart. It's until you actually read the recall, and blissfully, in this particular case, it's preemptive. I'm not looking for anybody to have massive problems like you used to a decade ago when you had to have significant number of deaths before anybody recalled a vehicle.
And that's a good point. And that's the reason for the recall, too, is to prevent deaths. You don't, that's why that recalls.
Plus, if you can catch it early before there are big problems, it generates better goodwill than if you wait until people have died, and then you have a much bigger stigma of unreliability attached to your vehicle.
Yeah. Well, as with the airbag issue, it's tough to get ahead of that because they're behind it and haven't been able to get ahead of it.
Right. Yeah.
Well, on a different subject, the seizure in North America of defenders. There's an interesting article in Jalopnik called Why Are the Feds Obsessed with Seizing These People's Old Trucks? There's a good review of what's happened over the past couple months with seizures and getting the trucks back and not getting the trucks back. But the point I wanted to bring up, they have it's a long article, but I think it was well worth reading, too.
It was nice because it really sort of covered the whole issue and the things we've talked about, with our updates and that sort of thing. It kind of all condenses it into one place.
And they talk about what they call the Mercedes Law, and I'll read a bit of it here. It says, until the 1980s, Americans were mostly free to import just about any car they wanted. Et cetera, et cetera. And then apparently they claim that Mercedes-Benz and other car companies spent millions of dollars lobbying Congress to pass some rules in 1988 to heavily restrict the importation of foreign cars. And that's when the Transportation Highway Safety Administration kicked in and put in the 25-year rule and the 21-year rule for the EPA.
Which is incorrect.
And that's another reason to bring it up, to correct the record.
Well, the age exemption rule is older than that. And, in fact, it has been possible to import things, but it wasn't a free-for-all until the Mercedes Law, like this article represents. I can remember in the early 80s reading stories of the procedure, and you had to get a registered importer and post a bond and all that sort of thing, just like the law reads now. The significant difference in the so-called Mercedes Law is that in the late 80s, they tightened up that process and made it much more difficult to find loopholes and to skirt the procedures. Mm-hmm. Not that it's any more or less legal. It's just much harder to bend the rules.
Bend the rules and get around it, yeah. Well, they also bring up the fact that, Canada is at 15 years and we're 25 and,
Yeah.
Sharing the same air.
That's another issue entirely.
Yeah, but it goes along with it. I mean, it's interesting that we were 25 and they're 15. Why the big disparity? And not to mention that if you want to import a newer vehicle, it's probably going to be safer and it's also probably going to be better control of emissions. That in some ways, by doing it the way they do it, you're actually putting on the road cars that are not as safe as they could be.
Well, and the point behind the exemption is that they feel that when they reach that age, there's just not that many people that are going to want to import them. And statistically, the sample is pretty small. And, we as defender enthusiasts sort of fly in the face of that. But in general, if you look at the big picture, there aren't that many vehicles that old being brought in. I will mention in reference to the lobby from Mercedes and that sort of thing, a lot of that happened because the manufacturers of the the problem was not just Mercedes, but it was a lot of the premium brands, Mercedes, Porsche, Ferrari, that sort of thing, the very expensive cars that you couldn't get here that were being brought in, and they were being converted rather questionably to get around these rules, and a lot of the registered importers weren't very good, and so there were a lot of the so-called gray market vehicles that were really rather unsafe, and there were a lot of accidents, and these manufacturers were getting sued, and that's the impetus for the lobby and the tightening of the rules.
And I want to throw in one more thought, if I could. That's very well put. There was another impetus that came from the dealer network. Remember, dealer franchises are controlled largely by state laws. There's a lot of pressure within each state to protect the franchise of a dealer. The dealers were finding themselves being asked to meet warranty claims on their Mercedes, which in turn was really a European issue Mercedes, at a time when neither safety nor emission laws were that similar between the two marketing entities. The time you could get a much faster Mercedes with perhaps much better handling, but greater emissions if you ordered it through a German outlet. The American dealer network was finding itself being asked to meet warranty claims for parts they couldn't even bring into the U.S. And at the same time, Mercedes USA, facing quite a sales surge in the popularity of the mark, needed to protect the franchise itself and the value of the dealer franchise payments. So that lobby was a powerful mix, if you will, of interests, not simply the fact that indeed many of the importation rectifiers weren't doing a particularly good job. In the end, now, since 2000, you really do see the sort of inanity behind the legislation, because the European emission standards and the U.S. standards are much closer aligned, and the European vehicles in some ways actually exceed our safety standards, for example, in the area of pedestrian safety.
Well put.
Oh, I do want to just throw one out on the Defender article. I talked with the author of that article because I want to agree that it was a very well-presented one, except for the point that was raised earlier. It is an interesting dilemma for the American enthusiast. Many of my readers will say to someone like Matt and the enthusiasts in the UK, find me a pre-1989 Land Rover that I can bring over. And unfortunately, by the time they're 25 years old in either country, they're likely to need some restorative work. If the restoration work is done in the UK, it likely won't meet the standards that are unfortunately in the existing legislation. It's almost better to bring one over with a VIN number and in a condition and with options consistent with the year of manufacture, and then have it rebuilt or restored here than having it done in the UK.
You're absolutely right, Jeff.
I'm looking at one right now.
Best of luck to
that's
you.
What I end up doing.
Well, the one thing too, and I don't want to badmouth my friends across the pond or anything, but when you buy them pre-restored, sight unseen, it's difficult to gauge the quality of the work. If you get it as an honest vehicle in need of work, you know what you're getting.
That's true. Very true.
And then you have control over the process over here. You can have it restored any way you want it, to whatever degree you want to have it done.
To your specifications and
correct.
To your needs.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is kind of what I'm doing too, I guess. Yeah.
But yeah.
Which way you go, it's still a crapshoot. I mean, you're rolling the dice no matter what. Matt, you were going to say something?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. You know, the value of shipping out a Defender to the States is significantly higher than it would be to sell inside the UK. And as such, whilst there are plenty of reputable places to get Defenders from, knowing that there isn't really very much comeback, has seen a bit of a rise in people have come back. And the quality of some of the vehicles that we've seen if they're leaving the country is a little bit patchy, to say the least.
There is a risk that sellers in the UK are dumping things on the American market because they are so remote.
Absolutely.
Well, and then once it comes here, you're not going to send it back. I mean, if it's not what you thought it was, you know, you're just going to...
Right. What's your recourse? You're stuck with it.
You're stuck with it, yeah.
But
you spend $2,000 to get it shipped here, you're not going to spend $2,000 to send it back.
When I deal with importation issues, either for myself or for clients, I always look at it from a risk management standpoint. It's like we do our best from the description, but we also factor in the possibility that things could be much worse, and we make our value accordingly.
And absolutely correct. Being a customer of Harold's for that and importing two vehicles, it's thankfully worked out.
We've done all right.
We've done all right. Yeah, absolutely.
It's a simple figures game, really. If I was to sell a 25-year-old, you know, pre-TDI vehicle here, it has a value of maybe $3,000. To you guys, you'd spend a hell of a lot more than that to get that same vehicle in the country. That's really the difference.
Yeah. And that's, yeah. Well,
I would try not to spend much more than that, plus shipping, of course, because I know I'm planning on replacing a lot of stuff when it gets here.
Yeah. Yeah.
I buy vehicles abroad as rebuildable cores, you might say.
Mm.
So moving on to New Zealand and some fun Land Rover news. I don't know if it's really news. It's just more of a fun story. On Valentine's Day, Land Rover New Zealand, I think it was Land Rover New Zealand, they reunited a Series 1 that they had completely restored to four friends who owned the vehicle, and they no longer used it, and it was sitting and wasting away, and Land Rover in New Zealand noticed that, bought it, restored it to its good condition, and on Valentine's Day this year, they presented it back to them. And it's a neat video. It's about 3 minutes. It's, again, heartwarming and very nicely done.
A great gesture of corporate goodwill.
And a wonderful PR stunt.
Yes, which reinforces what I've been saying. They're really good at marketing.
Yeah. My favorite thing about that particular video wasn't the rebuild. You know, we've all seen rebuilds done before, but was the 2 points really, the stickers that they'd remade from the original stickers that it had on it, and then the photos that they went back and took from their own photo gallery. And I thought those two little bits of personal stuff within the video, that's really what set it off for me. Really well done.
That is advantage of being the company. You've got better resources for that sort of thing.
True.
You know, and I will say one thing that Land Rover has over other off-roading brands is that direct connection to their tribe, really. You see that kind of thing happen within the in the Jeep community. You would see that kind of thing happen, but I don't think you would ever see Jeep corporate come down, scoop up somebody's dilapidated vehicle, and bring it back to that condition.
You're putting yours out there, though, Dan, right, if they want to do that. Right?
You know, mine's pretty good as it is. The New York tried to chew away at it. I've got some little rust spots, but mine's in pretty good shape. But I know there's some others, you know, they're just falling apart with, sure, you know, weeds growing up through the engine bay because it's beyond somebody's ability or budget to rebuild.
Well, and it's not like you can fix that in an afternoon with a bucket of bolts and 12 spanners either.
No. That is true. That's true. You're not going to see a frame-off restoration.
On the Jeep discussion, Dan, I told you that the Bantam started here just north of Pittsburgh, right?
I missed the opportunity. I used to live up in upstate New York and drove through Pennsylvania a number of times and never did make my way over there for the Jeep Festival. It was always, you know, one thing or another. I was overseas or in the Mojave or somewhere else when it was happening, so... Just a matter of timing.
About 4 or 5 years ago. It's not, I don't think it's been going on that long, but it's getting bigger.
It certainly is. And it helps that there's a number of off-roading resellers or brands in that Pennsylvania area. I think Quadratec's headquartered somewhere in Pennsylvania as well.
I wouldn't know.
Yeah. I Quadratec's one of those brands that just sells other people's stuff. Anything with the Quadratec name on it is somebody else's just rebadged.
So. I will tell you that we took the 109 up to the Bantam Jeep Festival this past year and walked around.
Yeah, it was nice.
It was nice. It was cool. It was neat to
see. Were you welcomed with open arms? Mistaken for a funny-looking Jeep?
We didn't exactly drive in the front door with it.
Well, there's several things that go on. They have in a campsite, they have activities that go on, and you can camp on site, and then there's a little bit of an off-road course, and they do activities for the weekend. The event that we had gone to was in Butler, PA, which is the town about a 20-minute drive from the campsite. And in town, they had basically a Jeep car show. And then we parked off on a side road and then walked through and saw everything. So... You know, as he said, we didn't come in the front door, but I think we had some looks. I don't, you know, no one.
We got plenty of waves,
and we did get some waves. We got the Jeep wave, which was
there.
Nice.
You go.
And there were some military Jeeps there, which were really cool to see. That was I think
that was a highlight for me.
That was, yeah,
because that's the true heritage.
Absolutely,
Yeah. Yep.
Speaking That's of good heritage, stuff. Bob Marley had a Series 3, 1976 Series 3. It was falling apart, and some folks in Jamaica went ahead and rescued it from certain death.
And you heard that here first 2 years ago.
And restored it.
Well, you read it in Rover's magazine.
That's right where we learned about it.
It could be, but we did talk about it in a very early episode of our podcast.
Yes, very early.
It turns out that a corporate executive for the Sandals Resort was friends with the Marley family and the foundation, and got behind the effort to kind of rebuild it to make it a visual cornerstone of a Marley branding and museum. And at Rovers North, they received a request to help source the engine, which they eventually did, to find one in reasonable enough shape. A company that is the official importer of Land Rover, and I believe Jaguar also, ATL in the Caribbean, were behind the actual rebuilding and restoration. And we had a photo and actually ran a Facebook contest at one point of the box of Pats that was sent down to Jamaica. How much do you think it weighed in order to get that restoration completed? It's a wonderful story. I actually got to interview Sadella Marley, his daughter, who told stories about riding around as a little kid in it. And most interesting to me, though, was I sort of expected that I'd be talking to people involved with the Marley Museum or Foundation. In actuality, I found myself rooted through a public relations company, which was closely guarding access as to how this was going to be presented and marketed. And my assistance, if you will, for everything from photography to video came through the agency with the Sandals Resort. So it was very much of a joint effort, and one that in many ways was made possible by the enthusiasm for Land Rovers of one of the executives at Sandals.
Did I read somewhere that Sandals had some sort of official connection with the dealer locally?
That's my understanding, and I don't know if it's an official connection. I know that that they've had Range Rovers as livery vehicles at the resort, but there may well be a connection that the folks at Sandals, the executives themselves, are either customers and or friends of that dealer, and that's really how they all got behind it.
Yeah, and I definitely know that they brought the mechanics from the dealer, the technicians, over to look at the vehicle in the museum and see if it was a project they were interested in. And it was very nice to see that they definitely saw it and jumped on it. And they also had, while sourcing parts from Rovers North and all sorts of other suppliers around the world, they had a local body shop redo all the panels and make new panels where necessary by hand. So pretty impressive that they, worked as much locally as they did globally.
The video that they had, it's 10 minutes. It's worth watching, and it covers a lot of this material. Of course, we'll have a link to it in the show notes. But things that Morgan just mentioned about some of the panels being hand-done, you'll see that in there. And I think the connection between the various organizations, although the way Jeff presents it, it's very possible this is certainly a controlled PR activity. You take that for what you will. There's a second article that the BBC had on their auto section, which I thought was, again, a very good article to read. And we'll link in the show notes to that. I'm not sure if that I can add anything from that specific article, except I like the seats they put in there. They put neat little stripes in the seats. I thought that looked kind of cool. But anyway. But again, the family talks about how they grew up with a vehicle. They would drive around in it. They would like to sit in the back. It looks like it's a pickup, I think. Series 3, 76 Series 3 pickup. And they would sit in the back.
Because they could.
Because they could, and they enjoyed it. All right. Also in the news, more modern vehicle, the Evoque is coming up in 2016, and there have been some announced changes to it. The ones that I'll bring up from the article, this came from Autoblog, is that it will feature several updates, including a striking new headlamp design, and will feature LED adaptive headlamps. And so that's coming for if you're going to be buying a VOC later this year for the 2016 model, you're going to have some new front-end lighting display, which I assume will percolate through the rest of the lineup.
Enhance its utility in the mall parking lot, I guess.
You know, I want to throw out a thought, and Matt, help us here. I'm not certain if the U.S. pronunciation is evoke or evoke.
Well, in this country, it's evoke, as in it evokes a reaction from somebody.
Yes, yes, yeah. And I'm yes.
That was my take too.
So that was my take as well. I want to suggest that Land Rover finds itself with the evoke similar to what Mini finds itself. You have a very striking initial model that has sold like hotcakes for Land Rover. Of the top 20 vehicles in 2014 that spent the fewest days on a dealer lot, the Evoque was number 19. They spent an average of 17 days between the time of arrival in the U.S. and the departure from the dealer's lot as an average. That's extraordinarily quick.
Yeah, that's real quick.
And the dilemma is, what do you do once this initial surge has been met? How do you freshen this vehicle? What do you do to keep an interest in that sort of sub-model of the Range Rover lineup? It will be very interesting to see what changes come by in the future years to either freshen it or to continue to grow interest in it. Clearly, it's selling as is, but every dealer has to have some reason to capture somebody that year and identify the differentiation in model years.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting one, because the price of the Evoque is very aggressively priced, and we recently had the top of the range autobiography in for review, and we were very impressed with it, but it came in at half the price of the Range Rover, the full-blown Range Rover. And obviously, as they're trying to uprate it, I think the price of that's going to go up and up, leaving a gap underneath it for what somebody's been looking at in Iceland recently.
Spoilers. And now, the M word.
In the days following World War I, Herbert Austin's company was in trouble. Austin had been a successful builder of luxury cars before the war, and during the war, many lucrative military contracts resulted in exponential growth. When the war ended, he had a huge new factory, lots of workers, and nothing to sell. Europe just wasn't buying very many large, expensive cars. By 1921, Austin Motor Cars was in receivership. The only way to save the company was to make simple, inexpensive cars. Since England also taxed personal cars based on engine size, Austin felt that smaller was definitely better. In 1922, the Austin 7 was introduced. It was a huge success. Some consider it the most successful British car ever made. Since it was mass marketed as a car for the working class, it's often compared to Ford's Model T. However, in terms of global impact, the 7 was so much more. In post-war Germany, an automaker named Eisenach was facing similar difficulties to Austin. Eisenach was the third oldest car maker in Germany, after Daimler and Benz. They made a successful line of cars under the Dixie brand. After the war, when it became difficult to sell luxury cars, the company decided to shift its focus to producing small, affordable cars. In 1927, Dixie acquired the rights to build the Austin 7 under license. A year later, the Bavarian Motor Works purchased the Dixie brand and the Eisenach factory, and just like that, BMW was in the car business, making licensed Austin 7s known as the BMW Dixie. In the British seaside resort town of Blackpool, the Swallow Sidecar Company had been supplementing their motorcycle sidecar business by doing paint, upholstery, and bodywork on cars. They decided it made good business sense to expand into coach building, which is the practice of handcrafting a custom body on the chassis and running gear purchased from another car maker. It was common practice among luxury car brands, but Swallow felt there was good potential for affordable coach-built cars built on the Austin 7. In 1927, the Austin 7 Swallow was officially introduced, and it was an immediate success. The company relocated to Coventry and eventually began building complete cars of their own design. In 1945, the company was renamed Jaguar Cars Limited. At the University of London in 1948, a student of structural engineering named Colin Chapman designed and built a trials racer based on the Austin 7. Chapman called his car the Lotus Mark I and used it to test many new engineering concepts. This led to the formation of Lotus Engineering, which would later be known as Lotus Cars. It is no small coincidence that the most iconic example of the Lotus ideals of simplicity, superior handling, and light weight was known as the Lotus 7. It was so popular that its familiar shape was imitated by countless kit car makers, and 6 decades later, the 7 is still being made. One of Colin Chapman's biggest rivals, the legendary racing driver and car constructor Bruce McLaren, also got his start at age 14 in an old Austin 7. Not far from McLaren's native New Zealand, quite a number of Australian coach builders were producing custom-bodied Austin 7s. One of the most successful of these was Holden's Motor Body Builders, who would eventually become one of Australia's best-known car makers. Meanwhile, in Japan, the Datt Motor Car Company started developing a tiny car to take advantage of a new law in 1930 that allowed citizens to drive cars under a certain size without a license. They called their new car Datsun, meaning Son of Datt. It looked much like the Austin 7, and in fact it may have infringed some Austin patents. But by 1934, they had licensing agreements in place and were making cars with Austin's blessing. Datsun, later known as Nissan, became an international success, and Austin considered this to be the most successful of their many licensing deals. Nissan and Austin continued their good relationship well into the late 1950s. The American Austin Car Company was founded in Butler, Pennsylvania, for the express purpose of building licensed Austin 7s for the American market. Production began in 1930, and the car sold quite well in its first year. Unfortunately, the Great Depression all but killed the consumer demand for new cars, and by 1934, American Austin was bankrupt. The company was reorganized in 1935, and the name was changed to American Bantam. The licensing agreement was canceled, and American Bantam developed new cars of their own design, although they were still tiny like the Austin 7. In 1940, the company was awarded a contract to develop a prototype for a new light-duty military vehicle that would eventually be known as the Jeep. The Bantam reconnaissance car was well-received by the military, but concerns over Bantam's precarious finances caused the government to award the production contracts to Ford and Willys. Fewer than 3,000 Bantam Jeeps were built, and then the company converted all its production capacity to making two-wheeled trailers. After the war, Bantam's Jeep design would inspire the Wilkes brothers to design and build the Land Rover. There is much talk today in the automotive industry about global markets and world cars, but these ideas are nothing new. The Austin 7 was truly a world car. It was produced and sold on every continent and launched businesses that would become industry leaders. And when Austin, Jaguar, and Rover all became merged into British Leyland in the 1960s, the DNA of the Austin 7 had finally come full circle.
All right, now on the show, we've asked Jeff to join us because he just came back from Iceland and the Discovery Sport debut. And I saw your blog, Jeff. We need to push your blog, by the way. I didn't even know you had a blog until just recently, and you talked about going to Iceland. So we'll get that in the show notes. But I saw in the blog that you saw the details of going, leaving your vaulted island off the coast of Maine and the trip, and you went to Iceland. Can you fill us in?
I'd be delighted to, and I certainly want to thank Land Rover for the opportunity to have Rover's magazine as one of those, the many, I will say, selected from around the world to participate in the global launch of the new Discovery Sport. Those of you, Dan, Matt, who were either at or followed the New York Auto Show last year, saw the Discovery Sport concept. And the vehicle, the actual production of the vehicle, moved along quickly. The interesting part, there were many interesting parts of this, and I should perhaps explain my own interests here. One was to see how much energy at Land Rover focuses on the development of, I'll call them new models, or refreshing existing models. I can't speak to Jaguar as well because I don't follow it as closely. But I was very intrigued to be reminded that every model that Land Rover makes, and they don't make that many, has to succeed. Unlike a larger company like Fiat Chrysler, which can afford to have a model that doesn't work well because they can amortize the loss over multiple marks and multiple manufacturing, Land Rover really has to make every vehicle work, and it has to succeed. A loss, a really terrible vehicle, would be a tremendous loss for Land Rover. So the Discovery Sport that we saw at the auto show had been probably 4 or 5 years of engineering prior to the launch of a really intense group. I had the good fortune to meet Paul Cleaver, who was the development program engineer and director from Land Rover, who spoke to the assemblage of about 40 journalists on my group. And you realize that from the way Paul spoke, that his entire energies had been behind this vehicle for about 5 years, pretty much without much vacation. And the group, relatively small by automotive standards, that he had working with him, had to achieve something extraordinary with a relatively small development budget, and it had to meet expectations of 170-plus worldwide markets that Land Rover exports to. Now, I know that sounds like corporate speak, but the truth is this really has to happen. This isn't something they just make up, and it has to succeed, for Land Rover doesn't have the resources for a bomb. There can be no Edsels in the Land Rover world. So to be part of this worldwide group, including journalists from China and Japan, from Europe, and, of course, from the United States and Latin America, was a wonderful adventure for me as editor of Rover's magazine, and I really thank Land Rover for making it happen. We spent a total of 4 days each, and I believe there were 6 waves of journalists, probably 30 to 40 journalists in each group, being brought to Iceland, and Iceland, I'm sure, was chosen because of a relative centrality if you're flying people in from around the world. A pretty good airline in Iceland Air to get you from multiple places there. You're arriving in the winter, which is not the high tourist season for Iceland. And I will say that there's a genuine winter up there. It was quite something to be a part of.
And you know winter.
And I do know winter, and I have to grant the Icelanders, they know winter too. The other interesting part, Dan, was related to something that you alluded to earlier in this podcast. It was very interesting to me. Iceland as a whole has only 320,000 people. To go around the entire island nation is only about 800 miles of circumference driving. So it's not a particularly huge place and not heavily populated. And easily a third of all those people live in the Reykjavik area in southwestern Iceland. When you go off-roading in the winter in Iceland, you are essentially off-roading on barely defined gravel paths encased in ice and snow. And at any time, you can be overwhelmed by sleet storm, whiteout, blizzard. You can be trapped for days. Land Rover had to really bring over quite a crew from the Land Rover Experience in Scotland and the UK, with Defenders and Discovery 4, diesel Discovery 4s, as, if you will, support and potential rescue vehicles. When it wasn't until I arrived in Iceland and found an English language magazine that I realized how common it was for people to be stranded for a day or two in different parts of Iceland, and they take it as routine. It's not something that makes CNN. There's no chatter on Fox News arguing over whose fault it was. They simply sit and wait. There was this remarkable story, and all of you in the U.S. will understand this, and Matt, this may be something that would happen in the U.K. as well. There was this marvelous story of a school bus, a coach, filled with about 60 school kids, high school students, traveling between two small towns. The road beneath the bus, just a gravel berm, if you will, in terrible winter conditions, literally dissolved underneath it, stranding the bus. It slid over to one side, not on its side, but such that it was trapped, wasn't going anywhere. The services couldn't reach the bus right away. You couldn't fly there. You couldn't helicopter there. And the roads being as they were, you couldn't just dash out on a road with big vehicles to go get it. This took several hours before they were actually there overnight. Now, can you imagine what the reaction would be to a school bus full of children in the U.S. stranded overnight in Turkey? Heads would roll. In Iceland, it was news only to let you know that your kids are on the bus and they stayed overnight and they were okay. And it was simply part of the daily winter activity. That's the way you drive in Iceland. So the road conditions were such that the Discovery Sport really put through its pace just going down these totally ice-coated gravel roads and or off to the sides when we were on snow-covered paths in the national forest. We had a total of about 240 miles of driving, and about 35 of it or so was truly off-road, trails that otherwise would have been closed, but Land Rover was given permission to open those trails in the winter just to plow these lanes so you could experience ascents and descents and side slopes and so on so you could get a feel for the vehicle off-road. Sadly, it was on our group that one of the vehicles driven by a couple of journalists from the West Coast went off the road and, I believe, onto its side. So while everybody was okay, what Land Rover confronted, particularly if the journalists driving were not familiar with driving in winter conditions, was something that the gamble they took by having it in the winter. It was the vehicle itself is going to be, I predict, a tremendous seller for Land Rover. Matt, you're absolutely right. It is priced just below the Evoque in the U.S. market. It's going to start at about $36,000, and it will go up to about $45,000, depending on how it's optioned out. It's a 5 or a 7-seater. It's the Evoque engine and drivetrain, so that's the 9-speed automatic on the 2.2-liter turbocharged engine. All the off-road capabilities you would want are there. It really acquitted itself very well. We had studded snow tires on the vehicle, all of them, as they are sent to Scandinavian countries, and it really acquitted itself very well on off-roading. Things that I would worry about as an off-road enthusiast, like how much engine braking do you really have on a turbocharged engine, were answered very positively. You have tremendous amounts of engine braking because you can really select where you want to be in that. Very comfortable in the best sense of the word. 28 mile a gallon highway for those interested in fuel economy. Good looker, looks better than the concept vehicle, Dan, that we saw at the 2014 show. All in all, I was very, very impressed with it. I think that it's a wonderful replacement for the LR2.
I'm just wondering, Jeff, the engine you drove is the current SD4 engine, which they put in the Evoque and in the X-Type Jag, I think. But the new Ingenium engine's coming out soon. You think the engine that's in it is worth buying, or would you reckon to hold on for the Ingenium?
One of the reasons, Matt, that I would buy the vehicle when it comes out for myself is that, A, I don't know when that change will happen in the U.S. B, I don't know when they will make a diesel option available. I know it's talked about for the Range Rover here, the full-size Range Rover, but it may work its way down. The other nice thing is that the Evoque engine and drivetrain for the U.S. market has been wonderfully trouble-free for Land Rover. And as we were talking earlier, Land Rover reliability issues for all the different systems aren't as high as some of their competitors. They're better than they were, but they're not as high. This, however, has been a winner. So I would be comfortable getting it. I'm not certain that you need anything more than what it offered, except at the highest end of performance. Admittedly, Matt, I am a Series 2A driver. I have a 1966 2A. Performance is a foreign concept to me. It seemed to be just fine. And I rode with journalists who were far more experienced with the competition and for the on-road performance and dynamics, and they pronounced themselves to be quite pleased with it.
Did you ford a stream or a river?
Oh, this was so hokey, guys. you know, if you're an enthusiast of off-roading, fording streams is like a baptism. You know, nobody wants to drown the baby at the baptism, right? So this one was indeed a stream. They found a location. They got permission from the Iceland government to ford this stream at this point. You went up essentially to sort of the top of the wheel wells, no more. You know it could have gone further. You know it could have gone higher. They actually stationed a couple of Land Rover experienced instructors off to one side out of camera view to make certain that no ice flows came down and smashed into the vehicles. The stream was running rapidly, but nothing that was going to push a vehicle around. It was clear that somebody had checked the bottom out pretty carefully, so you weren't going to do any damage to either vehicle or ego. But I will tell you, if you've never done that before, and many of the journalists on my group had never forded a stream before, they were beside themselves. There were GoPros running the whole time. They brought their cameras out. They photographed each other. They were just, God, 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 can you believe what it did?
Like Japanese tourists.
So, yes, and to the point, as an aside, to the point that they stationed a videographer on the other side who filmed each one of us driving across and then offered us the video as well as an opportunity to speak as a voiceover in the video. So being vain, of course, I took the opportunity to speak as voiceover. And when it was sent to me, I shared it with the sole Land Rover dealer in Maine, in the Portland, Maine area. They've always been friends and thought they'd get a kick out of seeing it. They're so enticed by it that they want to use it as part of their advertising, their television advertising coming up. So the idea of fording a stream is just huge, even though if you're an off-road enthusiast, you know it's routine and done all the time.
So, Jeff, I have a question regarding the appearance. Was there much discussion about how it kind of has a similar appearance to the Ford Explorer?
You know, Dan, when you see it in person, some of that gets lost. It lost some of those Jerry McGovern Ford Days styling tidbits that were on the concept car. So it doesn't quite look as Explorer-like in person as the one we saw when we were in New York last year. But the other is that the current Ford Explorer really has a much bulkier look to it right now. And I don't think it's really going to be an issue. I'll tell you, none of the journalists who were there and who routinely are around conventional automobiles brought that up as an issue to them. I think those in the Land Rover world were more horrified at the thought because we still haven't really recovered from acknowledging that Ford actually did some good things when it owned Land Rover. And I'm confident, Dan, that there are Jeep enthusiasts worried about Sergio Marchionne every moment of their lives right now.
Yeah, that's a pretty big understatement. Especially with, it's just all the Fiat involvement and what they're threatening to do. But yeah, the new vehicles kind of have a similar look, just because it has to meet the different CAFE regulations and the safety crash standards. It's kind of dictating the design of a lot of vehicles. So I was hoping to see the Discovery Sport with something a little more, something a little different than what it was. But I like the way that it sounds like it's well-priced for the entry-level new off-road vehicle.
It's very well-equipped, which is a positive. And I want to address the issue that you raised because it's an important one. Much like Matt was noting about the Range Rover Evoque, the Discovery Sport is really not necessarily meant to talk to people already convinced to buy a Land Rover. It really is speaking to a group like the Evoque did of people who never quite saw themselves in a full-size vehicle. Now, if you're a Land Rover fan, you are undoubtedly still bemoaning the loss of the original pure Discovery One, the first generation Discovery. This Discovery Sport is within inches of the identical dimensions of the Discovery One. It will be every bit as nimble as the Discovery One. It even has a slight elevation of that middle seating in that rear seat, the so-called command position that we all loved in the Discovery One. But ideally for Land Rover, it's to bring people to the brand who hadn't thought of themselves as Land Rover owners before. And as much as the purist or the diehard thinks that that's totally unnecessary to do, after all, my Land Rover is now 49 years old. I might buy a second one day. Land Rover desperately needs people to enter the Land Rover ownership fold and to stay with the brand. We don't have an easy way for them to do that, certainly not a financially accessible way, until the LR2, which didn't do it. It had too many competitors, particularly Subaru, that knocked it out in this country. But the Discovery Sport should do what Land Rover needs it to do, just like the Evoque did for the Range Rover.
Can you talk a little more about the size, like the interior size? So if it's the same size as a D1, like interior-wise, it's supposed to be, what, 2, 3, and then a two-seater in the back? I know it's a two-seater.
Yes, John, it's wider. Now, not a whole lot wider, but the way that it's designed and some of that rounded feature actually allows you to have more expansive room inside. It's 2, 3, and 2 is the seating arrangement if you buy the HSE model with the two rear seats, the third row seats. The interesting part that they did, and I don't know if anybody else does it. I've never heard of it before, so help me out here, guys, if you're familiar with this. The middle seat, the seats 3, is adjustable. Not just the rake, but the whole thing moves back and forth. So,
in that particular one, when the middle seats are back, you can't actually get anybody into the plus 2, seat 6 and 7, essentially. So the middle seats have to be slid forward a bit in order to get the people in the back.
It was certainly awkward when it was all the way back, but even when it was in its middle position, you found some leg room. And the old Discovery One, that was the big challenge for the American market, is it just wasn't much leg room back there.
When it was released in America, were the seats inward-facing on the Discovery One?
The very first ones were inward-facing, yes.
Yeah.
It was a big sales point, the jump
seats. We called them jump seats.
Right. The D2 had the forward-facing jump seats, and the D1 had the side-facing jump seats.
Right. Yeah. I don't think reclining center seats are particularly new. I think there's been some cars that have had them, but they certainly haven't been standard in any vehicle that I'm...
A lot of luxury cars have them, but I don't know.
Yeah, no, I meant that the whole bench seat, if you will, the whole thing will move back and forth so that you can adjust for legroom.
Oh. Oh, that's interesting.
I've seen that in cars, but not in SUVs.
Yeah. Right. So it was a great feature that allowed you to do more with a 100-inch wheelbase than you would have thought. But Matt is absolutely right. The two rear seats are nice little buckets, but I wouldn't want to be there for a long trip. And I'm not that tall.
How about storage space behind the...
Oh, once storage space is greater than the LR2, despite having only the 100-inch wheelbase, it's very well laid out in that sense. You could put a lot in there, and we did. We had a lot of our gear. We often rode for part of this global launch four to a vehicle with a lot of gear tucked back there, and no problem at all.
So with that third row seat up and in its seating position, you actually had more room for than just a row of grocery bags?
No. That's when it's folded down.
Okay. Yeah, because I remember when Jeep announced the Commander, I went and looked at that, and I just walked away laughing. I mean, once you have that seat up, then it becomes completely unusable for anything other than, I don't even know you could fit a full-size soccer ball in the back.
And I think that comes across in the marketing material, doesn't it? They don't call it a 7-seat. It's a 5+2.
Exactly. Well put, Matt. Yeah.
Right.
Well
right.
put. But it's a dandy vehicle. And if I believe that for Land Rover enthusiasts who've been reluctant to purchase even a used LR3 or 4 or an earlier Range Rover because of fuel economy and cost issues related to just an older vehicle – it's priced right, it's sized right, it performs well when you're not going off-road, and it's a dandy vehicle off-road. Really,
so
very
what you're
effective.
Saying is that they finally got the Freelander correct.
They got the entry-level Land Rover right for the U.S. market. You know,
you're going to dig at me.
No, we just
dig at the Freelander. The Freelander missed the mark on what it was intended to do, and this sounds like it's doing it.
Well, certainly the Freelander 2 did. It was, to me, it was everything special for North American market. Freelander 1 was nice for the North American
market. It was a nice vehicle, but I think it missed in terms of price per feature.
Go ahead, Matt. Sorry.
I think one of the interesting things now, you touch on the Freelander. So the Freelander came out and looked like a RAV4 or a Vitara or many other vehicles. It looked like an SUV, whereas the Discovery Sport is a very different vehicle in so much as in the back, or from the back, it looks very similar to a VW Golf and many other vehicles. So actually now, from five different car manufacturers, you have every vehicle that anybody would ever want on their driving journey. You start out, for example, in a small Toyota IQ, and the more that grows, it grows into a VW Golf, then it grows into a Disco Sport. And aesthetically, they look the same. Handling-wise and comfort-wise, they're all kind of the same. They're just slight progressions. So whilst the Disco Sport isn't as aggressive-looking as Land Rover enthusiasts like, it is a more tangible next step for somebody to upgrade from their typical family hatchback cars. And that really, I guess, for everybody that owns a Land Rover, who isn't divorced, has a wife who will drive something else and may want to be persuaded into a Land Rover, that's where the Discovery Sport really fits in.
So you're
saying it's not too far away from... Exactly. That's exactly what I'm saying. It's
a Defender. Defender's not the gateway truck?
No. The Defender's the hardcore stuff.
That's the hardcore, okay.
That's straight shooting, that one.
That's the heroin.
That's true, mainline. Yeah, yeah. Well,
there's one other thing we have to remember. The Discovery Sport, just like the Evoque, is Land Rover's entry point to meeting U.S. CAFE standards. Jeep faces the same issue. Land Rover has a limited range of product that have to make the miles per gallon requirements for fleet average. They've got to have these vehicles, or they're not going to be able to be available in the U.S. market.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think that Aston Martin's gone away, I think, pretty much for that reason. Because that Signet failed. It was their small little car that was in the hopes of changing their cafe average.
Nice try, but no.
That wasn't even a nice try.
They overshot in a couple directions on that one.
It's horrible. Absolutely horrible. Well, Jeff, we certainly appreciate you reporting from your event in Iceland. Is there anything else you'd like to bring up, or anybody have any questions?
Jeff, do you miss the weather in Iceland now that you're home?
It's the same thing.
It's very similar. The interest. I want to put a pitch in, though. In general, if off-roading is in your blood, and you want a genuinely unique off-roading experience, I can't recommend a trip to Iceland more forcefully. We'll have an article on off-roading in Iceland in the upcoming issue, precisely because it offers the enthusiast something so different than what we are used to in the U.S. And it doesn't even matter really what time of year you're there. It will be different, visually striking. The off-road enthusiasm there is enormous. What off-road means is different, closer to the European model than it does to the U.S. model. But the opportunity to drive in a totally different manner in a totally different environment and to perk your senses in Iceland is huge. And I would urge any of our listeners here to consider it for an off-road experience.
You know, and on that note, I had a discussion on Twitter just this week. You can get a free stopover if you fly on Iceland Air, going to any of their 25 destinations in Europe, where you can have a free stopover there for, I think, like 4 days.
Yes.
Free stopover.
You're absolutely right.
That's brilliant.
It is brilliant. And you can rent a Defender in Iceland, and you can either go off-roading on your own. They'll provide you with electronic and topographical mapping so that you're safe, and they keep tabs so that they know if you're off on the side and stuck. Or you can join groups throughout the year. There's an
active club. Fly to England, do the Land Rover experience, and stop in Iceland and rent a Defender and do that too.
Yep. Yes, you can.
And that sounds like an awesome trip.
Let's all go.
I'm going to do it this year so you can see the Defender line in Tullahoe.
That's right. Go for the Defender tour and see that being built and then do some off-roading and do some off-roading in Iceland. Let's all go.
I love it.
Deal.
Matt, can we stay with you, Matt?
Yep. You can pitch your tents up in the gardens. No problem.
Thank you.
Well, this is coming together.
I think so. It'll happen. I know. And we can podcast from sure. Matt's house.
Sure.
I'll try not to lose that episode like I did when I was there in October. Yeah. Anyways. Thanks again, Jeff. Why don't we, any last comments about the Discovery Sport? Will you buy one? I know you haven't bought a new Land Rover in a long time.
I haven't bought a last vehicle age that I bought was 1980. That's my newest vehicle is a 1980 Triumph Spitfire. The Discovery Sport is the first Land Rover that I, as a single guy and a working guy and somebody who works outdoors, would consider buying new because it actually is right-sized, right-featured, and has the right capabilities for me. Yep.
So you can put cut wood in the back?
I could haul firewood. I could haul all my landscaping equipment. I can tow anything with it, and it won't get stuck. And I can also get, frankly, affordable gas mileage.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, so you should check out Jeff's on Facebook and you're also in the magazine. You will have pictures of Queen Elizabeth I. You call it the QE1, right?
QE1, right.
QE1, yeah. And you can – often it has firewood stacked up in the back.
I don't believe I've ever seen it empty.
No.
There's always something in it.
You're right.
The only time it's been empty is when it's been used on photo shoots and you have to empty it and clean it out.
I did read that.
Sacrilege.
I did read that. He got he had to clean it up. It looked shiny. Which
yeah, it doesn't last long, but it does.
I don't think that was his truck. I think he has his truck.
I have I have photos from Iceland and some of the details of how Land Rover organized it on my blog, which is called Behind the Steering Wheel, and it's on Blogspot.
There we go. We'll have a link to that. And you're going to also have this in an upcoming edition of Rover's
Magazine? Yes, this will be the cover story in the next issue of Rover's Magazine.
Yep. Great. Wonderful. Well, we're going to stay in Europe, but we're going to move a little bit. How's that for a segue? We're going to move to near Birmingham, and talk to Matt. Matt, you run Land Rovers Live, and you just had an announcement this past week, and you're making some changes to the show. You want to share that with us?
Okay, yeah. As you guys know, we've been going for a little while now since summer last year, and it's, you know, Land Rovers Live started out as a bit of a hobby project for us, and it's sort of taken off a little bit from there, really. So we're at the stage now where we're going from our usual home on the internet to out onto broadcast television in the UK, and that's, you know, presents us with a huge opportunity, I suppose we'll see in time how good it'll be. Hopefully we think it's better than what we're doing now, but it wouldn't have been possible without the support of people like yourselves and the many viewers that we get back all over Europe, really. So there's a few changes, as many of you, if any of you have seen the show, you'll realise I'm not a jobbing presenter, more a Land Rover enthusiast who can string half a sentence together. But it's time for me to sort of take a little bit of a sidestep and introduce some people who can do that better. And so that's the plan. So we're building a new studio, which would be really interesting. I'm going to keep a little bit under wraps, but to say that it's 20, 30 foot in the air. So that's cool. We've got some new presenters joining us. So going for maybe a little bit more of a Top Gear style theme, but hopefully keeping the emphasis on content. And really just expanding who we're reaching. One of the things with Land Rovers, as we all know, is really not much has changed for a hell of a long time. So coming up with new content every couple of weeks is difficult. We've made that twice as difficult by switching from bi-weekly now to a weekly show, which will launch in about 10 days' time.
Wow.
And wow, yeah. Well,
will you continue to archive the show online?
Absolutely. So between you guys on the internet, and I won't say this on the broadcast show, is broadcast is all well and good, and is, you know, good for new wide audiences, but the internet is our home, and it's where the most of our concentration is going to be. So we're going to be producing a show which is a fixed length on television. And it'll probably be up to twice as long when it goes out online. So you're effectively getting an uncensored version online, which will feature a lot more stuff that we really think. So we can go into in-depth interviews, and I guess we have Ofcom in the UK, and I'm not sure who regulates your TV over there.
Nothing similar.
The Bible thumpers.
Yeah, I was just going to say, whoever it is poorly chosen.
FCC.
But yeah, that's it, the FCC. But obviously there's a lot that we can do on the internet that we can't do on TV. So the idea is to use the extra exposure of TV and the potential sponsorship that brings to really produce a much better show online and do something a little bit better. But obviously that all depends on people watching and people like you guys supporting, and we try and support everybody else as well to produce something that's good for us all. It's not really about my ego, and I stress that from day one. I'm just another guy who enjoys Land Rovers, and whilst that's enough, we'll keep doing it.
Yeah, I certainly appreciate you continue to push a podcast. You did the last full episode, and I appreciate that. That was very kind of you.
So the TV show is going to be like your gateway drug then, to bring people to the website and see the more stuff.
Get them under the hot stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also a really nice opportunity for us to dive into the stuff that we wouldn't ordinarily do. So, you know, as I'm a daily Defender driver, and I occasionally get a chance to drive some of the other vehicles, but I'm not that up on them. And I haven't driven myself around a Land Rover Experience Center for a long time. There's lots of stuff I haven't done which I'm really looking forward to getting back into, and also seeing through the eyes of people who are getting into off-roading and different types of adventure. You know, I've
like Dan, I have a family now, so it's not a case of just tearing up the countryside as and when I fancy. My adventures are slightly different, and I want to bring a little bit more of that to the fold. And can you go overlanding with three young children and a wife and keep everybody happy? And I think that's going to appeal to more people, and the TV side of it gives us a chance to really test that.
So is this a television network or channel that that has advertising? So do you have like a proper budget now? And
Define proper. It's
one that exists.
Yeah, well,
more than just your back pocket. You know.
Yeah, well, at the moment the lights are still on behind me, as you may see, but yeah, it's where we're at is we're getting a lot more interest, and I think Dan touched on it earlier with the success of his 4x4 podcast that you know people start to call him asking for reviews, asking for various different things, and you know, we're in a similar position now in so much as people know we exist and start to trust what we say, and that's. You know, that helps because we're not, you know, like you guys, we do it for the love and we've never made a penny out of it. In fact, we've lost a small fortune doing it so far. And if we can stem that hemorrhaging of cash, then we'll be on to a winner. And the broadcast side of it certainly helps us do that and get more people involved as well.
What is the channel that you'll be on?
So in the UK and... It's very complicated, but effectively it's Channel 8 on Freeview, which will go out across the centre of England, and we're looking over the next few months or so that'll expand further afield and have most of the UK covered, touch wood, by the end of the year.
Is that like a local access type channel?
Yeah, kind of. It's just the way the antennas are set up in the UK means that certain areas do, certain areas don't. So I live pretty close to where the antenna is, but I don't get the channel because I live at the wrong altitude. Some do, some don't. But it's I think 2.5 million viewers or 2.5 million homes will see us in week one, and we'll go from there. And they say 6 million by summer. So. But it presents us with a really nice opportunity, and not just us, but you know, there's in the UK, and I'm not really sure anywhere, but there hasn't been a broadcast slot dedicated to just Land Rovers before, so that's kind of cool. And we're, you know, if nothing else, we're proud that we can do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's going to be odd seeing a studio without wheels and roll up windows.
I know. I like the studio. I like that when you're in the front of the Defender.
Yeah, well, the absolute truth of that is purely a timing thing. The one thing I always have with me for consistency is my Defender. we've tried doing it different ways, but it's, you know, come rain or shine, the Defender cab has always worked.
Aren't you doing a frame over?
A frame over?
Didn't your frame have a problem? Weren't you getting your frame redone?
Ah, yes, chassis, yeah.
Chassis,
yes, well, so I have two Defenders. One of them is in bits, being completely rebuilt from the ground up at the moment. That was a bit of a shock, I'll be honest. It only went in for an underseal to be sold.
Of course.
as I imagine is a story people have seen many times themselves. And so they ran the descaler over it and found a whole load of holes, so that's... That's now, it was either put it in the bin or do a full rebuild. So that's been fully rebuilt.
Your daily driver.
Well, I have two Defenders. That between the two, that keeps a daily driver.
Okay. That's half of his daily driver.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm in the other one now, but that seems to be showing some signs of wear. We'll see how far we get.
Wonderful. Well, good luck with the new venture.
Thank you.
And I hope this means that you're now that you've become broadcast, that means you don't forget about your podcast family.
Well, will episodes of the broadcast show be available on DVD for those of us who are slightly out of range?
I'm not sure I can remember what DVD is.
All right, fair enough.
It's everything will be online, and as always, we'll be really ramping up all of our social network stuff and, you know, supporting you guys and coming on, and we'll have you guys on the show as well whenever we can. I'm not sure about DVDs and VHS. We'll take a look at that next year.
VHS, all righty. Now we're talking my language.
Yes. You're not changing the name of the show, are you? Matt, are you changing the name of the show, or is it staying there as long? Ask that question.
Do you want an official line on that, or
you want to answer?
So we don't think we are. Yeah. So, the idea is for online use. It's no stranger to anybody who's into Land Rovers that if you sport the name Land Rover anywhere, chances are you're going to get in trouble at some point. It's happened to many people, but we've always had a pretty good relationship with Land Rover. However, switching from being a little internet station or a little internet program to being a television thing has made them look at it slightly different. It's possible we may have to change the name, but right now we're going for it. So we'll see, you know.
that's the reason why this is called what it's called, because I didn't want to ever get too close to that.
Yeah, so we're going to roll the dice and see what happens.
Sure. Yeah, just as an aside, folks, we on Rovers Magazine, we actually had to go to Land Rover and be certain that we had permission to use the Land Rover logo and to retain the name of Rovers Magazine, and to make sure everything was really clear and comfortable with them. I'm sure if the parent company, Rovers North, hadn't been a part of the Land Rover network itself, that would have been much more difficult.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you're one of the few that's been able to keep those letters in your name.
Yeah. They've even talked to even the Land Rover clubs here in North America.
Yes.
Because I know our club got talked to, and apparently they do have a special exemption or provision that if you're a club, then there's no...
Just as an aside, on the club issue, in talking with Land Rover, the real issue, the so-called exemption, is really that Land Rover wanted to make certain that the clubs using the name were indeed nonprofit organizations. Mm-hmm. So the ones that were registered with the IRS as nonprofits really didn't have the problem. It was the events or using the Land Rover name or clubs that were informal, but were often operated by very enthusiastic businesses where the business depended, if you will, on Land Rover connections to make it work. Those are the ones that they really asked for them to reorganize so that they were truly nonprofit organizations in order to be able to use the name with comfort.
Yeah, no, I just really what Jeff said, that's absolutely right. But as Jeff will probably know, that when you call up a Land Rover dealer, you can get one response and a very cooperative, happy people talking to you. When you call up Land Rover Legal and have a discussion with them, it's a very different tone, and the wheels turn very slowly. So, we're doing all the things we need to do, and we think we should be okay with a name, but we've got a bit of a window of uncertainty, so we've made a decision to roll the dice.
Well, thanks, Matt, for sharing your changes that are coming up, and good luck on your new venture. Keep us informed. You're always welcome back to the podcast at any time. So good luck.
Thank you.
And now we'll move into our new Heritage segment. Every month we want to remind ourselves, if we haven't already done it, about the heritage that is Land Rover. That could be a good name, too. Heritage is a good name for something if you're having a trademark problem. So I'll turn it over to our heritage correspondent. I've decided that's what to call you, that Morgan. You're now a heritage correspondent since you run seriesparts.com.
Sounds good.
What are we talking about this month?
We're going to slowly work through series vehicles, at least to start, and just sort of go system by system. I figured, some of the drivetrain and safety features would be a good place to start. So brakes. Everybody knows that series Land Rover brakes are designed to stop the vehicle eventually, and keeping them, keeping old series vehicles on the roads here in the U.S., it's getting a little more important to keep those, in good condition or upgrade them if possible. So I wanted to go over some of the upgrade options. There are a few. Some of the Series 2 and early Series 2A had, correct me if I'm wrong, single series brakes. With the Series 3, they moved into a dual circuit.
In North America.
In North America, yes.
Most of the World Series 3 still had the single circuit brakes.
Really? I actually did not realize that the rest of the world still had single series. Wow.
I worked on a Series 3 in my shop not too long ago that's still single circuit.
Amazing. So, yeah, one of the easiest upgrades there is just moving to the dual circuit, and they're a power brake, so that they are vacuum-assisted with a servo booster, no longer share the fluid reservoir with the clutch. So you can do that upgrade. You can switch to a Series 3 dual power pedal tower and servo. Switch
if
to
you
the
can find one.
If you can find one, yes. and you can
good application for seriesparts.com to go look for your pedal tower.
Absolutely. And so going from there, that gives you, you know, a little more reliability. In the brakes, obviously, with the power brakes, a little more stopping power. They are still going to be not as effective braking if you are facing uphill as they will if you are braking downhill, because of the way the shoes are oriented. So you can actually go to disc conversions, which will help with, you know, that reverse braking. Performance after water crossings or in wet conditions, specifically water crossings where your drums will fill up with water, and significantly easier maintenance, that's for sure. There are a couple of companies who produce disc conversions. You can either do front only or you can do front and rear. Currently, there are three companies that I'm aware of that are actively producing conversions. Heisty Automotive in, I believe they are the Netherlands, and there's also Forbine Brothers here in the U.S. They have new knuckles that they produce that you can mount your ball joints to and everything, that they will take Defender rotors and calipers and pads, so keeps everything right in the Land Rover line, so pretty easy to get parts for.
Is that based on the Tim Cooper design?
The Forbine Brothers one is based on the Tim Cooper design, so okay, that was through let's see, originally Tim Cooper. I think Rovers North for a while there did a version of that, and then there was a company, Rome Off-Road, who did it a few years ago, and now that's moved on to Forbine Brothers. And Heisty, they've done a couple of different versions of that. So their 2010 and newer line uses the Defender parts. Their older line used a different set of parts. And then here in the U.S., there's Toral Industries. They use fairly standard U.S. parts. So like AC Delco rotors and pads. So a little easier to get parts over here, but honestly, getting Defender parts is not too difficult. So a couple options there. And then in terms of increasing braking power, because, you know, switching over from drum to disc is going to give you some benefits. It's not necessarily going to make it actually stop any faster, because you're not getting stronger pedal power. You really, if you have a Series 2 or 2A, you really have to do the dual circuit power brake upgrade to do the conversion to disc brakes. But there are also some options out there for increasing your brake booster power. So I don't believe it's available anymore, but Heisty Automotive used to provide an 8-inch Santana servo. So originally the Land Rover Series 3 servos are a 6-inch. So that gets you some more power on your brakes. You can actually also switch over to early Defender brake pedal tower and servo. They're also an 8-inch, so that can give you more braking power, especially if you're running a 109. That's a good bet to move to. Once you move outside of the very early Defender models, start getting into some wing cutting and fender cutting, so not necessarily the cleanest, easiest modifications. There are obviously lots more modifications than just these, but that's sort of the rough overview of getting to upgraded brakes. There's also some... Yeah?
I think the 8-inch booster conversion from the early Defender is going to require some fender cutting on a left-hand drive truck, maybe not on a right-hand drive truck, but I think on the left you will be cutting.
Yes, I agree. I think honestly, in fact, even on the right hand, there's a little bit of cutting involved, but it's much more minor than on the left-hand drive.
I was actually looking at the parts in my shop recently and thinking about that conversion, and I may find out for you soon enough.
Nice. And I actually have to suggest everybody go out and read Terry Ann Wakeman's Land Rover Expedition.info site. She has actually compiled a lot of this information. I believe that she recently, within the last year or so, upgraded a lot of the booster info, had people go out and do some measurements for her. So there's a lot of photos, a lot of details. It's a great place to start.
A great resource.
It really is.
I want to put a pitch in for one of the simplest improvements you can make prior to making the decision to go disc brakes, which I certainly can't argue with. But one of the best steps you can take is to actually get new brake drums on your 88 or 109. You'd be amazed at how worn the drums can get from just constant use, adjustment, etc. You really do pick up braking power when the drums have the right circumference.
Absolutely. And I would also suggest, you know, a general maintenance of your brake system is pretty important. You know, you want to have, certainly on an old vehicle of that age, you probably are good to replace all of your lines, all of the rubber. In fact, I believe that Land Rover suggests replacing all of the rubber in your brake system every 2 years or so, at least on the series vehicles. So most vehicles well past that that mark. And there are some options for those of us who live in the Northeast and who run into some corrosion problems. There is an alternate brake line option that is Kunifer, which is a copper nickel alloy. It's been used in, it is approved for use in brakes. A lot of foreign manufacturers do use it. I believe Volvo has used it for quite some time. Much easier to work with, but is far more corrosion resistant than steel lines. So another thing to consider.
If I could add here, there is another way to increase your stopping power that doesn't require any modifications, and that is to change your front drums and shoes to the 109 six-cylinder spec. Also used on the Stage 1 V8s, it's a half an inch wider, so there's more area.
Very nice. And can you do...
right up.
And will that bolt right up on the, I assume, on the 88s as well?
Yes.
Nice. That is an excellent suggestion.
And the parts are available still.
Very nice. Bonus. So, yeah, I think that pretty much covers, you know, the general brake upgrade options. Yeah.
I went from a single system with no power boost to the Series 3 system of my 2A back in the early 2000s. And there's no question that when you hit the brake, the booster does increase the force that you might not otherwise have with your foot at that moment. And that at least that eases your heart rate in a dangerous moment. But it also in some ways masks when the shoes really need replacement. It we all know if you've had the early system, that famous double pump, that is the first sign that you're really going to have to either adjust your brakes or replace the shoes. It masks the double pump. And
you do lose feel in the foot.
It hides from you the fact that they're deteriorating at the fairly rapid rate that they do because they were relatively undersized for the use of the vehicle when it was first designed. The disc brake option would be fabulous. It's not inexpensive, but it would be a fabulous safety addition to the vehicle. There's no question.
Yep. Yeah, and as you say, it is not inexpensive. I think normally you're running about $2,500 if you want to do just the front brakes, and that's just for fittings and the new knuckle hardware. So that doesn't actually include the rotors or calipers or pads. So yeah, it's expensive.
For those who are listening who do not drive a series truck, the vehicle doesn't get that fast that quickly. So a lot of times the easiest way to stop is to simply take your foot off the accelerator, and it quickly will slow. It's been my experience.
Yeah, that's,
there are times when it's true. There are times when it's difficult to know if your foot is actually on the accelerator.
Many times I have the accelerator on the floor, literally, and you still hope there's nothing else for it to use and get moving with. But I like to tell people that are in the passenger seat, I go, I got it floored, and we're doing 30 miles an hour, so I'm not taking off. Well, thank you, Morgan, for adding to our monthly Heritage segment. And what are we talking about next month?
Haven't quite decided yet. Obviously, it would make sense to move up the driveline, so maybe there.
Excellent. Good deal. And that brings to a close the 23rd edition of the Center Steer Podcast. Next month on the plan is the Lizzie Bus folks are going to join us on the podcast. There was an article just in the latest edition of Rovers North magazine, Rovers magazine from Rovers North. You may want to check that out. We're going to talk to them next month. But I want to thank everybody for joining us and give everybody a chance to say bye on the way out. So I guess I'll start. Harold, thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks for having us here. Thanks for listening to us. We'll see you next month.
Mr. Garcia, are you still with us?
Believe it or not, I am. I've just been speechless listening to a pretty great podcast today.
Well, good. Well, thank you, sir. How's your series truck running?
It did not want to start yesterday, but I have high hopes today.
Yes, we're going to. As soon as we're done with the podcast here, we're going to go out and check on my 109 to see if it'll start. So, and here. From Vermont, we have Morgan.
Thanks again, and I'm looking forward to the next episode, which I believe will be our 2-year anniversary.
It is, and there's absolutely nothing planned for the 2-year anniversary. Let's go across the pond. Matt, thanks very much for joining us today and Land Rovers Live.
Yeah, and thank you so much again for having me on the show. And for those of you, well, I won't put any spoilers out there, but make sure you tune into the next Sense Steer because the Lizzie Bus people are quintessentially British eccentric. A lot of fun that will be.
Yeah, I got that from the emails, yeah. So I
yeah, be good. You ain't seen nothing yet.
Okay. Did you get my DVD, by the way?
I did. I think I thanked you at the beginning of the show, or maybe even before we started recording. I got the Sense Steer sticker as well, which it's been a bit too wet to stick to the truck. But
one of the rare few Center Steer stickers, yes.
Thanks for that.
Thanks, Dan, for all your help and assistance and patience in joining us on this podcast.
No, it's been my pleasure. I've enjoyed it. And like I said, this is a great episode to really be on because there's such a wide range of Land Rover rock stars, as far as I'm considered.
Well, you're one of them.
Just by proximity, I guess.
You puts me in the group. You were in a military spec 110. Done. You're done. You can go home.
I'm already at the pinnacle. That's it.
I think that's killer to me. And finally, Jeff, I consider you a kind of an elder statesman of the Lynn River community. Hope that's okay to call you that. And we'll thank you as my final guest today.
I thank you for the opportunity to participate in this terrific podcast. I've had a great time. Dan, it's been a pleasure to listen to wisdom from the other part of the country, and wish you best of luck in Alaska. And Matt, congratulations on your new television venture. I wish you every success, and I'll keep an eye on it, and we'll let our readers know through our social media that you're on the air.
Thanks very much, everybody, for listening. And don't forget to share this with your friends. It's good Rover Karma. I've decided that's my tag going out now. Good Rover Karma. Bye, everybody. We'll see you.
Bye. Thank you.
The Center Steer theme song, Sunset Rider by the Tritons, is available from Mivio's Music Alley. Check it out at music.mivio.com.
Mark Garcia, are you with us? I guess Mark looks to be there, but I don't. He's not saying, we're not hearing you, Mark.
The part of Mark will be played by a cardboard statue.